This is number 0081, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0081. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, we have a return visit from Bart King. He's the author of The Big Book of Spy Stuff. You too can learn how to use a dead squirrel in the espionage game.
First they are brought to a taxidermist. They are, I would say, stuffed, and then a little space is left within the dead animal to insert a thumb drive or whatever other small item you want to keep secret. And then spies use the term dead drop for leaving something of sensitive nature, you know, maybe by the side of the road or in a secret spot, let's say a park if it were a squirrel. So if you were to throw your thumb, your squirrel that has a thumb drive inserted into it behind a tree in an out-of-the-way spot in a park, this is not literally your dead drop, another agent could come along and pick it up and take off with it. Obviously, that would look a little odd, picking up a dead squirrel and putting it in your pocket, but I'm sure stranger things happen.
Bruce Philp is the author of Consumer Republic. He believes that we do have the power collectively to affect company brands.
We've always had a certain fundamental power in that we could deny corporations our money. But what's changed in the last couple of decades is that we also now can deny corporations their reputations. We have the power to influence the value of the names that appear on those products. And increasingly, the economy depends on that more than it does manufacturing, as people, I think, probably realize. So the marketplace has become fundamentally a democracy.
And L.D. Cross is the author of The Underground Railroad, The Long Journey to Freedom in Canada.
The Underground Railroad, I find, is one of the great escape stories of North America. It's also one of the great people movement stories. And we're much more familiar with Europeans in small boats coming over to North America. But we tend to overlook the movement of people from the south of the U.S. through the northern states and into Canada.
Plus, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0081, is Jay Bartleben, the program director and assistant webmaster at CyberStationUSA.com. Yes, the same CyberStationUSA.com that this show, the Stuff File Program, is heard on. By the way, CyberStationUSA.com has joined forces with Worldviewer Incorporated to unravel the all-new website CyberStationUSA.com. Actually, it's more than a website. It's a complete portal, a fully integrated and interactive broadcast and social media portal. It features our new site, which includes video chat and video messaging, integrated video email and video conference calling, live video streaming, integrated multimedia center for pictures, videos, music, files, video comment posts, interactive calendar, video profile, and much, much more. And every second item has the word video in it. Visit CyberStationUSA.com for more information and sign up for your very own personal profile today. And thank you very much, Mr. Bartleben, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, you know how we always say everything seems to happen at Walmart? Well, that streak continues. In Orlando, Florida, a 70-year-old man was found dead in his van just a few feet away from the entrance to a Walmart. But the weird thing is, police say he may have been there for days. Shoppers said they noticed the man living in his van for several weeks. He was found slumped over his steering wheel about noon. It will be up to the medical examiner to try to figure out just how he did die and when, but police don't suspect foul play. As of yet, the man's name has not been released. Wow. Dead for days and found inside a van at high noon in Florida. Just how ripe do you think he must have been? Whew. And nobody noticed because, you know, the sales just keep people mesmerized at Walmart. Moving right along, the Reverend Grant Storms, the New Orleans Christian extreme fundamentalist known for his bullhorn protests of the Southern Decadence Festival in the French Quarter, was arrested after he was found allegedly masturbating at a public park. The 53-year-old reverend was taken into custody at Lafreniere Park after two women reported seeing him going at it in the driver's seat of his van, which was parked near a carousel and a playground. The two women flagged down a park employee who notified the sheriff's office. The good reverend claims he was having lunch at the park when he decided to urinate using a bottle instead of the restroom, and that's why Mr. Happy was out. The deputies didn't buy it and booked him with obscenity. A self-proclaimed Christian patriot, Storms has railed against the Roman Catholic Church, calling it satanic and demonic, and is especially known for arming followers with bullhorns, Bibles, and picket signs to protest Southern Decadence, which is a three-day gay festival held in the French Quarter during Labor Day weekend. You know what they say, those who scream the loudest. Yes, the Lord works in mysterious ways, doesn't he? Okay, moving right along. Believe it or not, beer is about to be legally classified as an alcoholic drink in Russia for the first time ever. It's all part of the Kremlin's tough anti-alcohol campaign since the fall of the Soviet Union. Up until now, beer had been classified as a food, which meant producers could avoid a crackdown on alcohol advertising and nighttime sales. But a new bill will abolish beer's special status, dragging Russian alcohol regulation right into the 21st century. The new law will restrict beer sales at night, ban its sale in or close to many public places, such as schools, and limit cans and bottles to a maximum size of 12 ounces. Russia's beer consumption has more than tripled in the past 15 years, boosted by low prices, ready availability, and lax regulation. Interesting crackdown for a country that has done wonders in harnessing the alcoholic properties of the potato. Meanwhile, Iowa is America's top corn-producing state. Bourbon, by definition, is a whiskey made of a grain mixture that is at least 51% corn. Yet amazingly, there is not a single bourbon producer in the entire state. Well, Jeff Quint, founder of Cedar Ridge Distillery, has decided to change all that and says, "It seems odd to me that we're in the heart of corn country, the best corn-growing region in the country, and nobody was using the corn to produce bourbon." He added, "We want it to be close to a mainstream bourbon. When people taste it, we don't want them questioning what they're tasting. We just want them to think to themselves, this is a good, solid bourbon." The company bottled its very first bourbon last summer, and because sales have been brisk, the distillery plans to rapidly expand its bourbon output. It now ages its bourbon in full-size Missouri-produced barrels, and aims to up its output from 3,000 cases to 4,800 cases a year. And we have one more story in this Stuff File News section of the program before we get to our first guest. I'm guessing the irony gods must have been bored. In Los Angeles, a drunk driver smashed his Ford Explorer right into a sober living home. Yes, this is where recovering alcoholics go to learn to live without booze. The driver and a passenger were trapped in the vehicle until rescue workers got them out and took them to the hospital along with four residents of the building who were also injured. And this ends our booze trifecta portion of the program. There you go. And I didn't do any of those stories in dedication of Charlie Sheen. Just so happened to come up that way. Nothing special. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the program, shall we? It was just around this time last year that we spoke to Bart King when his book, The Big Book of Gross Stuff, came out. Well, now he's out with another book. This one is called The Big Book of Spy Stuff. Bart joins us on the line right now. Hi, Bart.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you back on the show, and I have to ask right off the top for legal reasons, does Homeland Security know about you?
Yeah, I did have to inform them that I was publishing a book steeped in treachery, lies, and deception, and they seemed okay with that. So.
Okay. Now, you do have a line of books that are all the big book of whatever stuff. What led you to spy stuff?
Oh, it's a good question. You know, I actually, in addition to big books, I had a pocket guide series, equally vile. And one of those books was The Pocket Guide to Mischief. And in that book, I had a chapter on spying, which included an invitation to the Bart King School of Espionage, which had advanced courses in skulking and things like that. And I was kind of surprised that the reader response to that chapter in particular seemed strong, so I pitched a spy book in entirety, not just a chapter, to my publisher, and they seemed to like the idea. So here we are.
So how did you go about fleshing this one out?
I can say this. I do have a couple of friends who have served in intelligence fields, and so I began with them, some interviews that led me to believe that this was a fruitful avenue of research for kids. I mean, the thing is, you know, obviously adults are interested in this sort of thing, but it's an interesting thing, you know, because the world of ethics, for example, is very murky in espionage, and so I was wondering if that would translate well to kids, and of course it does, because no matter what our age, we are interested in secrets, you know, the power of a secret, obtaining a secret, tricking a secret out of somebody, and so forth. And so I remember one very early conversation I was having with one of my unnamed friends, and he said, you know, our prerogative, this former intelligence officer said, he said, our prerogative could be defined in three words, and this is his quote then, befriend and betray. And I thought, well, although that's chilling to hear an adult say that, I think it's also useful information for us to know just generally as citizens. And then for kids in particular, I mean, there is a certain amount of humor that can be mined there, you know, this notion that that a real spy is somebody who will always be untrustworthy. So is this really a career choice that we want to look into? Well, let's talk about it, you know. And I think, you know, beg your pardon for going on, but I think, you know, right now at this particular juncture in history, there's so much going on in the world of espionage that's changing. You know, WikiLeaks, of course, I hesitate to even mention it, but I mean, that's really kind of brought it to the forefront of everybody's mind. You know, what's the distinction between a whistleblower and a traitor? You know, and is there kind of a gray area between those that's acceptable? So I'll kind of stop there. But those were kind of my initial thoughts, I think, as I was putting the book together.
Now, you write this book, if I'm not mistaken, from a childlike point of view. For instance, you could learn how to escape tricycle riding assassins.
Yeah, there is a chapter on sabotage and assassination. And again, just kind of going back to a kid's point of view, as a child, I know that one of my favorite hobbies was making models. But after you make more than a half a dozen models, at some point you realize, well, what am I doing with these models? They inevitably would fall prey to firecrackers, and this would be sort of a self-sabotage. You know, you're actually taking entertainment from exploding your own work up, detonating your own work. And, you know, I think when you look at video games and things like that, there's no question that sabotage and assassinations are of great entertainment value, but as questionable as that might be, these exist in the real world too. So I just had kind of I figured I'd take a stab at a fun chapter on these topics. And so, for example, I talk about, you know, the most deadly weapon that most adults use every day is a car. I mean, here you are, you're behind a steering wheel of several tons of hard steel, and if you're not careful, you know, anybody who gets in your way is going to be history. You know, and kids obviously have their own non-motorized vehicles for their choices, so it's not a how-to, it's more of a self-defense manual from the assassin who might be mounted on a bicycle or a skateboard or, as you mentioned, a tricycle. So, for example, in the tricycle section, you know, the danger, of course, is that the three wheels can leave nasty rubber marks as they go over you. The best defense from a tricycle riding assassin would be to avoid spots where trikers hang out, like playgrounds and triker bars. So that gives you an idea. That gives you an idea of the level of humor you're dealing with here, Peter. But nonetheless, it's still a fun topic to kind of get into that way, and then to talk about more current and serious topics as well.
Well, you know, I'm Canadian, so for us, right, the answer to that is simply hockey stick in the spokes.
Yeah, there you go. I like the sound of that. And, you know, I should point out, since you mentioned that, you know, Canada is part of what's called the Five EYE Allies, which you may or may not be familiar with, but most people, I suppose, aren't unless they had a reason to. That's a group of five nations, which would be the U.S., Canada, Great Britain, New Zealand, and Australia. And the idea is that these countries have a very unique pact between them. It's an alliance, really, and it's for espionage. It's designed specifically for espionage. And basically the pact is, we won't spy on you if you don't spy on us, and we'll simply share intelligence. Which is all well and good, but, you know, there are skeptics on both sides of all five of those countries' borders that kind of wonder, well, how do you verify this? And the answer is the only way you could possibly verify you don't spy on us, we don't spy on you pact is by spying, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because you mentioned five countries. Did you say the United States, Canada, Great Britain, New Zealand, and Australia, correct?
Yes.
As an American, wouldn't you be concerned because the other four, and I'm part of those other four, they're all Commonwealth countries.
Right. I know. So right there, right away, there's a click within your alliance. That's an interesting point. Yeah. So, you know, I don't want to say that the U.S. intelligence community looks with suspicion upon their four allies in the Five Eye alliance, but it's possible. You know, the thing is, you know, that Canada probably should be more concerned. With other countries, you know, you may have seen there was a recent report that actually came out of Canada kind of looking at Chinese espionage, the kind of development and level of Chinese espionage that was going on worldwide. And this particular one came out about 4 years ago, I think. It found that the best estimate they debriefed Chinese diplomats who defected from China and taken other measures to kind of get an estimate, and they figured that there were probably about 1,000 spies, Chinese spies, in Canada alone. Now, that includes informers, so, you know, there's kind of a fine line between a spy and an informer, but still, that's a pretty substantial, you know, amount of people. Now, they didn't, this particular Canadian think tank didn't then extrapolate from that, but if you look at population ratios, and if you assume that Canada is of equal interest to the Chinese authorities as the U.S. would be, then that would put, you know, the level of Chinese spies in the U.S. at about close to 10,000. So it's kind of interesting to think about that. You know, the fact is that anyone who lives in an urban area probably at some point unwittingly has crossed paths or at least been in the line sight of a professional spy. Of course, there's no way of knowing it because a good spy is the one that you never know is there.
Well, I'm in the media, so that could be daily in my case.
Well, once you start thinking along these lines, no doubt your colleagues, are suddenly under suspicion. So.
Now, I understand you can discover how squirrels can deliver top secret messages, too.
Right. Perhaps in less good taste, but the fact is, you know, as I was going about my research, I found that animals have a kind of a rich tradition in the history of spying. For example, the ancient Greeks had a cute trick, which was resurrected more recently by the French in their version of the Vietnam War, where they would take a dog and shave its coat and then tattoo a message upon the animal's skin. Of course, the catch is you have to wait for the animal to then grow its hair back before the message can be delivered. So it can't be a super time-sensitive message, obviously, if you're going to do this, but the odds of getting caught with that secret message are very low. As for squirrels, you know, small rodents are a little trickier because they don't do well with leashes, and they tend to scamper off. And so what rodents like squirrels have been used for is, first, they are brought to a taxidermist. This would be after death from natural causes, we would assume. And they are, stuffed, and then kind of a little space is left within the dead animal to insert a thumb drive, for example, or whatever other small item you want to keep secret. And then this would be, spies use the term dead drop for leaving something of a sensitive nature, you know, maybe by the side of the road or in a secret spot, maybe let's say a park if it were a squirrel. So if you were to throw your thumb, your dead squirrel that has a thumb drive inserted into it behind a tree in an out-of-the-way spot in a park, this is not literally your dead drop. Another agent could come along and pick it up and take off with it. Obviously, that would look a little odd picking up a dead squirrel and putting it in your pocket, but I'm sure stranger things have happened. You know, the main drawback with that particular technique, by the way, which I just want to repeat, I am not making up, is that cats have been known, even though the squirrel, they make every effort to sort of take away any tastiness of the squirrel through the process of stuffing it. Cats have been known, and other predators have been known, to grab these things and take off of them, which you could imagine would make everyone very sad. So squirrels are integral to good intelligence work, I guess, to sum up.
Very quickly, because we're just about out of time, I know you write these books with tongue firmly planted in cheek, and they're all for fun, but in this day and age, a lot of people don't have a sense of humor. I joked at the top about Homeland Security. Are you worried about somebody coming your way and saying, excuse me, Mr. King, can you come with us?
You know, to keep it brief, you know, I should point out that the CIA did a fascinating study where they concluded that really most of their good intelligence work was simply reading, discriminating among public sources of information, which is more or less what I've done. And so to test this, a CIA operative hired a half a dozen historians and said, we'd like to hire you for this with this grant money. Take 6 months, and using public information, please give us basically a status report on the U.S. military, which sounds like a ludicrous assignment, but these guys went to it. After 6 months, the historians turned in their research, again, based just on public information, things that you or I could gather. And when the CIA operative saw what this panel of historians had gathered, and he was shocked, and he showed it to his colleagues, they immediately stamped it top secret, disbanded the panel, and asked people to speak no more of it, because it was frightening how good their intelligence was. And again, I'll just point out that this was all just, you know, by dint of reading and paying attention, you know, to the world around them. So I'm not too worried, you know, and basically I'm too immature to bother with, I think, Peter. I think we can see that. So
bottom line, we don't need 10,000 Chinese spies in the United States or 1,000 in Canada. All the Chinese needs is Google.
It's correct. You know, that Russian band of, what was it, about 10 spies that were broken up on the East Coast of the U.S. recently amid great media celebration. That was mocked in the intelligence community because, like, when one unnamed operative said, all they needed was one guy with subscriptions to the New York Times and the Washington Post, and he probably could have gotten more done than those 10, you know, embedded agents who really accomplished not much. So good point taken. Yeah, absolutely.
The book is called The Big Book of Spy Stuff. It's written by Bart King. And Bart, I thank you once again for being on the program.
Thank you so much, Peter. Appreciate it.
Bart King, author of The Big Book of Spy Stuff. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the Stuff File program page for this show, which is show number 0081, and you'll find links to Bart's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're experiencing The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the author of Consumer Republic, plus we'll talk to the author of The Underground Railroad, The Long Journey to Freedom in Canada. And of course, we have an idiot of the day. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. And leave it to New York City to come up with the world's first same-sex animal wedding. Yep, Ollie's Place, a cat adoption center, recently found a unique way to celebrate a special bond between two adoptable cats. It held the world's first same-sex cat wedding, The tail-joining ceremony united Solomon and Bruno, two adult males who depend on each other and are looking for a forever home they can go to together. Mike DeCerto, who works at the center, said he was trying to come up with a good promotional idea to get Ollie's Place some much-needed media attention and donations. Well, mission accomplished. There's a video of the weird wedding on Facebook and YouTube. And yes, I've put a link to that video in the Stuff File website, so you can go there on the page for this show, number 0081. Mike also reports that Solomon and Bruno are still very happy with their decision to tie the knot. Two male cats getting married. You know, there's an obvious crude joke here, but I'm just going to let that one pass. Yes. In Brooksville, Florida, the dispute between 35-year-old Thomas Gannon and his girlfriend, 31-year-old Tina Cash, started when she unfriended him on her Facebook page. It ended up with both of them in jail. Tina also changed her relationship status to single, so Tom confronted her about this at their home. Yes, they live together, and says Tina began throwing things at him, including a framed flag belonging to his great-grandfather. She also allegedly hit him in the face with a picture frame. Tina says Tom had been throwing items as well and that he had punched her in the head. So police arrested both on a misdemeanor domestic battery charge, and both are being held without bail. So this all started from an unfriending, huh? Good thing she didn't poke him. And in Quincy, Illinois, 27-year-old Jared Drew Hill had just gotten his tongue pierced and was driving home when an unexpected side effect occurred. The poor guy passed out at the wheel and thus hit a traffic sign, a bush, and finally a house. Hill sustained minor injuries, but no one else was hurt in the crash. He told police that he had just come from the Quincy Mall where he had received a tongue piercing and was headed home. Hill said the last thing he remembered was driving when he apparently just passed out. No alcohol was involved. Basically, just the aftershock of having a hole drilled in his tongue. I can get that. This is God's way of saying, you know, you're not supposed to have a hole drilled in your tongue. I bet you can no longer say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious and other such words. Anyway, moving right along. Who knew there was such a thing as a meat hall of fame? Oh, I've got to go there. Well, there is. It's in Wisconsin, and the Meat Industry Hall of Fame will be inducting five new members this spring, including the Munchkin Coroner from The Wizard of Oz. That would be Meinhard Raby, who represented Oscar Mayer and company as Little Oscar and played a key part in the company's early efforts to gain brand recognition. Now, Mr. Raby took a leave from his job at Oscar Mayer to play the role of Munchkin Coroner in the movie The Wizard of Oz. See if I can get this right. Okay.
She's not only merely dead, she's really most sincerely dead. Okay, you can stop now. Yes, you can stop now. Really? You can stop now. Come on, stop it.
Thank you. The resulting celebrity further propelled the Little Oscar character and Oscar Mayer products to new markets throughout the nation. Raby died in 2009. Inductees will be recognized at the annual meeting of the Wisconsin Livestock and Meat Council, which takes place on May the 12th of this year, 2011. I'm pretty sure tickets are still available, but check into that just in case. Anyway, let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? According to Bruce Philp, the author of Consumer Republic, the power to save the world lies with the consumer. That's the foundation of his message. Brands make corporations accountable. They are the only leverage the average consumer has with which to make a company behave itself. Now, Bruce is on the line with us right now from Toronto. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So we as consumers actually have the power. I'm sure there's a lot of people who don't necessarily believe that, but you say that's true.
Indeed. I sometimes wonder in my darker moments whether a lot of people don't want to believe it because it comes with a certain amount of responsibility. But it absolutely is true. We've always had a certain fundamental power in that we could deny corporations our money. But what's changed in the last couple of decades is that we also now can deny corporations their reputations. We have the power to influence the value of the names that appear on those products. And increasingly, the economy depends on that more than it does manufacturing, as people, I think, probably realize. So the marketplace has become fundamentally a democracy.
Is part of the reason why that has happened the explosion today of things like social networking and the like, that people who are concerned about brands or concerned about how a company runs itself can voice their opinion and more people hear it?
Yeah, without a doubt. I think that, you know, the book argues that the roots of this go back to before the age of the internet, but the most tangible and easy to understand proof of the power consumers has certainly lies in a discussion of the internet, in particular in social media. I was just noticing with some interest today a story in an American business magazine that talked about how it was about to become a $1 billion industry for research companies to figure out how to monitor brand sentiment online using social media so that corporations can understand in real time what we think of them. And you can appreciate that I found that timely and funny.
Now, you say that we as consumers can hold the power of making companies more responsible. The other side of that coin is the way people feel about companies today and their products that they make. People often hear them saying, no matter what the product is, you know, they just don't make things the way they used to. Is part of the reason of that the fact that we stopped making companies responsible, or we allowed them to be in the position they are right now?
Yeah, I think there's a good deal of truth in that. And I think that the companion of that is that we became a bit too obsessed with cheapness, if you like. You know, most particularly since the 80s, I would say that the North American consumer has been way more concerned with how much stuff he could get as opposed to how good that stuff was. And in a lot of product categories, you could see the middle disappear, you know, where there used to be kind of, you know, three tiers in consumer electronics, for example, where you had cheap stuff and you had, you know, pretty good stuff and you had really amazing stuff. That middle layer has gone because the market is divided itself into those who have a whole bunch of money and are willing to pay whatever it takes to get the best, and the rest of us who are trying to make our dollars go as far as they can. What the corporate world has done to respond to that is focus on making things more and more cheaply, which very often means making them further and further away. and so our houses are filled with a huge volume of products, but none of them are very satisfying to us. And the book argues that maybe that was a mistake.
I'd go even further and say in some cases some of the high-end things have disappeared, and I'll give an example of an item that no longer is with us because its generation has passed, and that is the VCR. There were three levels, I always say, of the VCR, but near the middle, the high-end seemed to disappear completely because everyone wanted a cheaper VCR.
Yeah, that's right, and that's a phenomenon that social scientists call diffusion, which ordinary people call the adoption curve. And what happens is a technology like that matures, is that the people who waited to buy are by definition cheaper, or by definition willing to spend less money. And so the tail end of the life of a technology tends to be characterized by, you know, things that are kind of not that well made. And certainly with VCRs, that was the case. I mean, at the end of the era of the VCR, you could get one for $89, and I will wager that the majority of those machines are sitting in, you know, garage sales and flea markets and dumps right now.
Now, do we have to change as collectively our mindset, because like you say, we want the cheaper stuff. We have to think differently, otherwise companies won't act differently.
That's right. I mean, our behavior as consumers effectively becomes the conscience of the system. I mean, my argument is you can only expect a corporation to do so much of your ethical thinking for you. You know, they're fairly simple-minded organisms that are, you know, dedicated to creating shareholder value. What we do with our money becomes the ethical standard for our whole system of commerce. So the book suggests, you know, what if we do this? Let's buy less, because we're going to have to if the world's going to support us all, and if our, you know, retirement accounts are going to be in decent shape. So let's buy less and let's buy better. In other words, let's buy things that last, because I know that a toaster that lasts me 20 years versus a toaster that lasts me 5 years is a more ethical choice, even if it's more money, because the cheap toaster only you know, quadruples the size of the market for toasters. And finally, let's be heard. And here's where it's very important to speak up when we're happy with something and when we're not happy with something, and trust that the conversations we try to have with corporations will both A, motivate them, and B, become part of what the world knows about those brands. And that's really where our leverage lies.
Isn't the double-edged sword of the toaster analogy the fact that if I buy a toaster every 20 years, the company will say, well, let's just cut back on workforce because we're not selling toasters every 5 anymore?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I'm not an economist, so I can't say with certainty what the consequence of that would be. But as a marketer, I would suggest that two things might happen. One is we might end up paying a lot more for those toasters. So if there are fewer toasters being sold, then the margin on each one is going to be higher. And I think that's a consequence that we as consumers have to be willing to bear. The other possibility is that we may see more manufacturing done in marketplaces that are focused on craftsmanship industrial economies that are focused on craftsmanship rather than industrial economies that are focused on volume and low cost. So for all I know, this could result in a kind of repatriation of manufacturing jobs. It's not out of the question. But in any case, I think the long-term benefits to individuals financially and to the system, both environmentally and financially, are probably worth paying extra money for that toaster.
Everything you say makes absolute sense, but can we get the genie back in the bottle?
Well, the book begins with a reference to sustainable development and the whole environmental movement that got started in the 1980s. And what I suggest there is that made a real difference because it mainstreamed the issue, A, and B, because it gave everybody an easy way to get started, in that case, recycling. In this case, I'm sort of saying, look, let's just do something. If you don't want to become a student of toothpaste manufacturing, then fine. But the next time you buy tires or a car or a television, do put a little bit of effort into that because those things are big. They have a huge impact on the planet and they cost a lot of money. And if you can just kind of make one conscientious decision this week and another one next week and two the week after that, and we all do that, we all do what we can, the low-hanging fruit here will not be that much effort. Where I think these conversations become paralyzed is when people talk about the magnitude of change that's required to make our economy sustainable, and really that's the last 10%. That's the real hard stuff that lies years down the road. But we've got some time here to adapt ourselves to simply being more conscientious, and I don't think that's going to be that hard. And I think it may even be, the book argues that if we can take things like social competition out of the equation and just buy in order to please ourselves rather than all those other funny, vain things that people do, we may actually find it more satisfying.
But you're talking about something, and again, we're talking about marketing here. We're talking about something that plays into the psyche of the individual. Isn't that what marketing does? It plays to our base elements.
Yeah, the marketer will do whatever works, and if that happens to be appealing to our vanity, then that's what they'll do. But I can tell you from having spent a lot of years as a guy who tried to sell you things, that at the end of the day, the choice still belongs to the consumer. I am unaware of a mechanism that allows us to make you do things you didn't want to do. And if somebody came up with one, I can assure you they'd be quite wealthy.
You mentioned you spent a career, 3 decades in business and advertising and branding. Was there an epiphany for you at some point?
I think the book was sort of stimulated by two things that happened about a decade apart. And the first one was the publication of Naomi Klein's book, No Logo, of which I'm one of the few people, I think, who read every word, which I thought was brilliant in a couple of respects, but an incomplete picture of what brands really mean to us. And then fast forward almost a decade to the recession that we're hopefully just coming out of now. And this one was unique because it created a lot of questions about the morality of consumption, and particularly in the United States, where consumer spending is so critical to the economy. And questions were being asked about, you know, is this marketing's fault, and have we all been fools? And I was just overwhelmed by this idea that we were going to throw the baby out with the bathwater if we weren't careful, that we don't want to live in a marketplace with no choice. It will not be a more ethical marketplace. It will not be a more environmentally responsible or sustainable marketplace. And we know that because there is not an example of which I'm aware of a managed economy with no consumer choice in, you know, recent history in the world that has produced those conditions. Our best shot is still a democratic marketplace. And so what felt like a turning point to me, you know, had a lot to do with me kind of getting out of the mainstream of the business, and it had everything to do with me wanting to kind of lay down this manifesto while I thought people might be willing to listen.
The book is called Consumer Republic. It's written by Bruce Philp. And by the way, you can check out his blog, www.brandcowboy.com. I thank you very much, Bruce, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for asking.
Bruce Philp, author of Consumer Republic. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program, and then the episode number for this show, which is show number 0081, and you'll find links to Bruce's website and either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. What would you say is the most expensive tool your doctor uses? An EKG machine? Or maybe an X-ray? No. According to the president of the largest private medical school in the USA, Drexel University College of Medicine, the most expensive tool a doctor uses is a pen. That's right. Because of how often doctors must use their pen to order extra tests that can be used as evidence if they're ever sued, the common pen is adding billions of dollars to the cost of our health care. Here's how bad the lawsuit problem is. That president told me that half of all the residents in his medical school who are training in obstetrics are sued at least once before they even leave school there. Let's be fair. What America needs today is medicine for our justice system. If we continue down this path, your wife or daughter may have to travel so far to deliver her baby someday soon that it endangers both her and her baby. Learn more. Go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the Underground Railroad, and of course there's an idiot of the day, but right now I have one more Stuff File news story to share with you. You know, the oldest joke in the comedy handbook has finally come true. A banana peel, the torment of many a cartoon character, has allegedly become the real-life downfall of a woman in California. Ida Valentine, age 58, is suing the 99 cents only store where she slipped on a banana peel last April. She said that she suffered a herniated disc and tissue damage, spent $9,000 on medical bills, and is seeking an unspecified amount in damages. She fell and landed on her backside, said Courtney Michelage of the Quirk Law Firm in Ventura, California, which is representing her. Michelage says the 99-cent-only store in Fontana, California, refused a proposed settlement of $44,000. Okay, a little historical context here. You know, the image in popular culture of an unwary pedestrian tripping head over heels on a banana peel actually stems from the late 19th century, when bananas were a popular street food in American cities and the press portrayed them as a public nuisance. In 1879, Harper's Weekly groused that, "Whosoever throws banana skins on the sidewalk does a great unkindness to the public and is quite likely to be responsible for a broken limb." So there you go, your history lesson. And speaking of history, let's get to our next guest right away, shall we? L.D. Cross is the author of The Underground Railroad, The Long Journey to Freedom in Canada. It shares the story of black American slaves who escaped from the U.S. in the 18th and 19th century. L.D. Cross, also known as Diane, is on the line with us from Canada's capital city, Ottawa. Hi, L.D.
Hello there.
Thanks for being on the program with us. This is looking back in time at the Underground Railroad, is this a bigger piece of history for Canada or for the United States?
I think it's probably bigger for the U.S., but Canada as well. We gained, they lost. But the Underground Railroad, I find, is one of the great escape stories of North America. It's also one of the great people movement stories. And we're much more familiar with Europeans in small boats coming over to North America. We're familiar with people walking on the land bridge from Asia into North America. We think of the land grabs when farmers and ranchers pushed out west in North America. But we tend to overlook the movement of people from the south of the U.S., through the northern states and into Canada.
Why is it overlooked? Is it because they were leaving and not going into the United States?
Well, I think it's because instead of trying to sneak into the U.S., they were trying to sneak out of the U.S. And we, at that time, did not have slavery here in Canada. But even when they arrived here, they still found that there was discrimination. So Canada is not entirely blameless either. So it's a part of our history that I felt hadn't received enough coverage.
When did you first start delving into this topic? And for you, in doing your research, what was the biggest revelation?
I started about a year ago. Going around looking at it, and I had initially thought that I would focus on how people got here from the states, that even though they reached some of the northern free states, they could still legally at the time be captured and returned to their owners in the south. But the more I looked into it, I found there was a vacuum in many instances of what these people did once they came here. How did they work into society? They were, in many cases, agricultural workers, so they could transfer those skills here, although the crops were different. They were skilled tradespeople at a time when skilled trades were needed, and many of them were very entrepreneurial. So at that point, I thought, well, you know, let's mention some of the harrowing escapes they had, but let's also look at what they did once they got here.
While slavery did not exist at that time here in Canada, what was the policy once they arrived? I mean, was it turning a blind eye to their arrival when they came to Canada?
Well, it wasn't illegal for them to come into Canada at the time. Borders were open, and they did find, however, that they preferred to go to black settlements like the Don Settlement near Dresden, Ontario, and around Windsor area, the Buxton-Elgin Settlement, where they could earn some land by working it. And there was still discrimination. In many cases, their neighbors thought that property values would drop if a number of black fugitive slaves moved in next door. So, you know, we were probably just as discriminatory as many of the Americans. It was simply that the British had passed the laws in 1834 to abolish slavery in the British Empire, and that, of course, included Canada as well.
Now, during the first part of certainly during the 18th century, but also part of the 19th century, Canada was not a country yet.
Correct.
Did the Underground Railroad have in any way, shape, or form any adverse relationship between the United States and, I guess, then Great Britain? Did it cause any diplomatic flaps, is what I'm asking.
Right. It didn't appear to cause a problem at all, in the same way, perhaps, that we tended to think that maybe the American Civil War would have precipitated Confederation in Canada to provide a more unified front against possible American invasion, but that was not true either. So the British simply passed the law, and all of their colonies, Canada included, followed suit. So there wasn't really any flurry of letters being sailed back and forth about what are you doing, and are you, sheltering our citizens, and you're keeping our property from being taken back to their rightful owners. So there didn't seem to be any of that hassle whatsoever.
You mentioned that there were several who were entrepreneurial in spirit, not just workmen or farmers.
Right.
Can you share with us some of the entrepreneurs who would have succeeded? For instance, I understand Toronto's first taxi company was actually founded by black slaves?
Right. Thornton and Lucy Blackburn were escaped slaves from Kentucky. And they made their way to Detroit, crossed over into Windsor, and ended up in Toronto. Now, Thornton worked as a waiter in the dining room at Osgoode Hall Law School. He saved his money, and he had noticed that there was no public transit in Toronto, as there had been in some of the cities he'd been in the States. And so he decided that he would get one cab built, and he painted it red and yellow and called it The City. It was drawn by a horse, and it held four passengers inside, and it had a driver who sat up in the box at the front. So it was really the precursor of the Toronto Transit Commission.
Interesting.
Which sort of surprises people, really. And there was Canada's first black cowboy was farming or ranching near Brooks, Alberta. John Ware was a skilled horseman and cowboy, and he had moved over to Oklahoma. He had worked on a number of the cattle drives and had made enough money to purchase property near Brooks, and he registered his own brand, and it was 9999, sort of known as the Four Nines, or the walking stick brand, if you want to imagine a nine as sort of a walking stick. But he was also the winner of the steer wrestling competition and the forerunner of the Calgary Stampede in 1893. So, he apparently was well accepted by his neighbors, he and his family, primarily because his skills as a horseman and as a rancher were well respected by his neighbors.
When you share this information with people and you talk about the book and the research you've done, who's more surprised, blacks that you talk to or whites?
I find that black students tend to find it, I didn't realize that. Well, and it makes them want to look into it in greater detail. The other very surprised group are white teenagers who start off with the notion that Canadian history is boring anyway. And they thought, I'd never heard of this. Why hadn't I heard of it is most often the question that I'm asked. And so my reply is, then ask your teachers why it isn't part of the course pack for your Canadian history classes.
And why do you think it's not part of the Canadian history classes?
I think we're probably just focused on the European explorers who came over here, whether they came for the fur trade or they were exploring for the Northwest Passage or they were putting a railroad across the country on that. We don't focus it as much on the niche contributions of people to the country. So perhaps that will change. I don't know.
And maybe it's your book that will help to change that.
That would be nice, but
the book is called The Underground Railroad, The Long Journey to Freedom in Canada. It's written by L.D. Cross. I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program.
Thank you very much, Peter. Bye for now.
L.D. Cross, author of The Underground Railroad, The Long Journey to Freedom in Canada. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program page, and then the episode number for this show, which is show number 0081, and you'll find links to L.D.'s website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And of course, it's time for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
A North Georgia man was arrested after police said he stuffed a rotisserie chicken, chicken wings, a mouth guard, and two toothbrushes down the front of his pants and walked out of a Walmart, there it is again, Walmart, without paying for the items. Police said the man left the store through the garden center with the items in his pants. Floyd County Jail and Rome Police report states that the 27-year-old by the name of Joseph Lee Stringer of Kingston, Georgia, was charged with shoplifting. He was released on $1,350 bond. Now, why would someone stuff an entire rotisserie chicken down their pants and think they could actually get away with it? One reason, and one reason only. He's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0081. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, it's 0081. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you can find me as PA Holder on both Facebook and Twitter. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise. Hope to see you back here on our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ, St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.